Well, I think I'm just going to get started. Hi. Thank you so much to the organizers, Dan and Yuhai, for giving me this opportunity to talk to you about some of the work that we're doing. I'm at UC Irvine, which is about 3.5 hours from here, and I'm actually a part of a P41 NIH center, which means that we develop technologies in imaging, specifically in fluorescence imaging. And I'm going to talk to you about some of our collaborative work that we've been doing on energy metabolism. And this is the overview of my lab. Specifically, besides my responsibilities of the P41 Center, I do have my own research projects. And one of the things I'm going to talk to you about today are metabolic alterations in both embryo development, neurodegeneration, and just a tad bit about cancer, and maybe like to pose some questions specifically about this, in mitochondria specifically. We also do other types of work in my lab. We look at the influence of the extracellular matrix, which hopefully I get a chance to show you, and mitochondria recruitment, and of course tumor organoid models. And some of the technologies that I've been fortunate enough to be a part of and to co-develop are, I'm going to talk to you today about the phasor-FLIM analysis, because it's, as Dan mentioned, FLIM is a very powerful tool to measure energy metabolism in living systems in a non-invasive way. You don't actually have to add anything to the system. And we work with multi-photon excitation sources, and that allows us to look at a lot of fluctuation dynamics. So looking at protein-protein interactions, we now have ways to calculate the molecular diffusion and flow as to how molecules will actually move within cellular systems. So if you want to know barriers to diffusion of molecules, we can map that out. And of course, that requires a specific type of imaging. You have to be fast, and you have to get the good signal-to-noise data for us to analyze. And essentially, that's based on fluctuation analysis. So looking at the photon burst as a function of time and cross-correlating spatial temporal bursts across space and time. So those are other things that we worked on, which I don't have time to talk to you about today. And we have other projects on DNA damage, and we've looked at how NADH is important in DNA damage and repair. And then other signal transduction pathways. So first I'd like to introduce, Dan gave a really nice overview of the FLIM analysis. I'm going to go a little bit deeper into FLIM and why NAD plus is not fluorescent, so I will talk a little bit about that. And of course, for us, I'm trained as a biochemist. I got my PhD in chemistry and specialization in biochemistry, but I spent 10 years doing biophysics, so I really consider myself more biophysics. And for us, what we would like to do is really to be able to explore these intracellular autofluorescent molecules within tissues. And so the whole idea is to be able to look in through a living, let's say, tissue and be able to characterize different diseases within these tissues, or maybe understand some molecular processes that occur, such as metabolism, with these intrinsic autofluorescent signals. So those autofluorescent molecules are collagen, elastin, keratin, NADH, FAD, porphyrins, and fibrin, just to give you an idea of that. And as I mentioned, we use multi-photon excitation. The advantage of this multi-photon excitation is the fact that if you use one photon, as you could see here, the laser just scatters throughout the sample. So essentially what you have is that the objective allows you to focus at a very small focal spot, but above and below that focal volume, you have also excitation. And so the problem with using single photon excitation in cellular systems is you get a lot of scatter. Of course, you can reduce the scatter by using pinholes and then just getting the light that's focused at that focal spot. But the deeper you go into tissues, this becomes a great problem. You actually don't get photons back. So if you're using multi-photon excitation, the advantage of this system is that you have actually to excite the molecule, the fluorescent molecule, with two photons, which have the half the energy as one photon. So two of these, the summing these two will make one, the energy needed to for the molecules to absorb the light and then eventually give off light in the emission process of fluorescence. So that actually really nice segue into fluorescence lifetime imaging. And there are conventional fluorescent microscopes can separate out fluorescence fluorophores using spectral emission. FLIM allows us to separate out the signatures of the light emitted of these photons with lifetime. So every single fluorophore that's known that absorbs light and gives off light has a unique lifetime signature. And that's the advantage of using fluorescence lifetime imaging microscopy. And what is FLIM? It's the average time that a molecule spends in the excited state and then emits the photon. So how long it takes for that photon to be emitted is called the fluorescence lifetime. And so here's just a brief outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about fluorescence lifetime imaging, how the lifetime is measured in the time domain versus the frequency space, and how is this FLIM set up, just a brief overview of how it's actually done. How do we actually detect these photons, and they're coming out in the nanosecond time scale. So that's a really fast time scale. How do we actually know when these photons arrive? And so some advantages, disadvantages, and now this is what we've contributed to the field of FLIM, because FLIM has been around for ages and people have been using, you know, these beautiful FLIM images, as Dan talked about. But we've actually contributed to this field by using a graphical representation of the data. And that allows us to actually understand these metabolic processes that are happening within cellular systems. And I'm going to show you that today. And I will show you some examples. So why do we do FLIM? FLIM is useful for other types of characterizations, such as force resonance energy transfer, intracellular mapping of pH. If you have, let's say, a dye, you can actually map out the lifetime of the signatures of the pH of that particular dye. And that gives you information, spatial, let's say, mapping of pH. Of course, biochemical reactions, such as oxidation reduction processes. That gives us, of course, NAD. Yeah.
I should know the answer to this, but I don't, so I will ask you. So are there good dyes to use FLIM for looking at pH inside mitochondria?
If the dye can go into mitochondria, or do you mean within subcompartments of the mitochondria?
So like if I just want to know what's the pH in mitochondria versus the pH in the cytoplasm.
Yeah.
Like are there good FLIM dyes for that?
There are definitely pH-sensitive dyes. Actually, GFP is they have genetically encoded pH-GFP sensors as well that you could use. But as long as the dye can permeabilize into the mitochondria and it's a pH indicator, I think it's useful. If there's a spectral shift or if there's something that's associated with the chromophore structure within the microenvironment, then it will give you a different lifetime. It should. But I don't know off the top of my head what kind of pH indicators would be specific to mitochondria, but there are many out there. Yeah. And of course, instead of using fluorescence lifetime imaging microscopy, you can use PLIM, which is the phosphorescence or long lifetime species.
So when you say intracellular mapping of ion trap concentration, you mean the spatial?
Spatial.
Oh.
Within the cell or within subcompartments within cells.
The spatial resolution.
Yes, so the spatial resolution is still diffraction limited, so that would be about 300 nanometers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to explain the time-resolved fluorescence, what's happening during the time of the fluorescence emission, and how do we calculate the lifetime. So essentially, when molecules become excited, you give energy to the system, right? And energy is the source of light. The electrons will be excited, and they will transition from the ground state to the higher excited energy states. So what we know about fluorescence quantum yield is that it can be defined as the ratio of the rate of the fluorescence and the sum of rates that depopulate the excited state. So this is with this formula here, it's the quantum yield, and this is the rate of fluorescence divided by all the possible rates within the system. So of course, electrons can undergo inter-system crossing, they could be non-radiative, so all of these rates are summed. And the natural lifetime is the inverse of the fluorescence emission rate. So our measured lifetime is the sum of all of the rates of the natural lifetime and non-radiative decay paths. So if we think, I know this is a really busy slide, but if we think about how molecules actually are excited, let's say this is your laser beam, and as the laser beam goes through your sample, your cuvette, you're not going to excite every single molecule all at the same time, right? So only a few of them get excited, and the rate of change of the population in the excited state will decrease with, and this is what this formula is saying, that the excited state population of the fluorophores is described by the rate equation here, where we're looking at N, which is the number of molecules in the ground state at time t, N star is the number of excited molecules at time t, and gamma is the rate constant of emission. So the dimensions of gamma are per second, and that's the transition of molecules per unit time. So the rate of change of molecules in the excited states depends on how much you actually depopulate the emission plus how much you populate because of the excitation. So imagine that the sample is excited with infinitely sharp pulse light. This results in an initial population of N0, or N0, of fluorophores in the excited state. And the excited state population decays with the rate of gamma plus the rate of the non-radiative decay. So NT is the number of excited molecules right after at a time T following excitation, and gamma is the emissive rate. So because it is a random event, each excited molecule has the same probability of emitting at any given time. Right? So the result then is an exponential decay in the excited state population. So that's what actually what we see is this decay. And this is expressed within this equation. So how do we actually measure this? How do we measure the time arrival of each photon? We don't have a commercial system. We bought several, but in our system, we use a field programmable gate array or FPGA chip, which we program so that it is synchronized to the laser pulse. This is our clock. This is our metronome. And this laser pulse is pulsing at about 80 megahertz. It's a really fast signal. So as soon as the pulse is given out, our FPGA chip records this time. And now the photons, the molecules will be excited. They'll emit a photon. And as soon as that photon hits the photocathode, our FPGA card has four sampling windows. And our whole system here is based on a heterodyning method to acquire the data. And using this sliding sampling windows, as you can see, this window zero is not always at the same time, right? Sliding every single time. And by having four of these windows slide, through the entire period of the emission response, we will have about 256 steps. And what that allows us to do is to capture every single photon as they arrive. And so no photon is lost within our counting. So this is just the illustration of how the digital heterodyning principle works. And it works quite well for our lifetime, which is going to be calculated in the nanosecond time window. These time windows here are picosecond time windows. So they're really fast.
Wait, sorry, I just got confused. If you're using a 80 megahertz laser, the time between pulses is shorter than 20 nanoseconds.
So between these two?
I was just confused by because here you have between those two, yes. 20 nanoseconds.
Yeah, in this case, this particular paper was written by Ryan Collier, and he actually used a modulation that was not 80 megahertz, this was 40 or 20 megahertz. So there's different, so you can use, I think 40 megahertz it was, so half of that. But yes, you have to be careful in using specific pulse lasers for this.
So the pulse has to be strong enough to excite everybody. Is it sending up too strong a signal to maybe kill some of them?
So the signal is, it's only single photons that will be excited. So unless, I mean, unless you have a very saturated sample, you're going to get million counts immediately. So it does depend on the concentration of fluorophores that you have in your sample, but it's, you're not going to excite all of them at the same time, right? So you could saturate this. We have saturated this card before, and that depends on the concentration of molecules.
You don't need to know the value of N0 since
right.
You don't.
No. I mean, you could calculate it if you wanted to know how many N0 molecules you start with. Yeah, and there's ways to calculate concentration of molecules using FCS, looking at the amplitude of the correlation.
You just try to figure out the time, the decay time.
Yeah, not, just the decay. Just the decay time. Okay, so our contribution to this field has been using a completely different way to look at the data, which typically what you look at is this emission decay, this green line that you see here. This is the time domain. This is the reason this is called time domain is because we're using excitation pulses. You can also take the data in a completely different way. You can use a modulated signal. So let's say you don't have a fancy two-photon laser in your lab or in your microscope setup, you can actually modulate lasers at a given frequency. And then this is the frequency domain. So when that photon arrives, that signal is converted to a modulated signal as well. However, because of the delay time between your reference signal and depending on the chromophore, the fluorophore's lifetime, there'll be a phase shift and an amplitude demodulation. And so you have a delta M and delta phi here that can be now transformed. Both of these raw data, right? These are all raw data, the emission decay there, can be transformed with the sine and cosine using the fast Fourier transformation. And we can plot now these two components, which are the G and S components, into this graphical plot. And actually, this is called the phasor diagram or analysis. And so what we have is that now let's say if you have very short lifetimes, the lifetimes will be on this side of the graph. And if you have much longer lifetimes, the lifetimes will be on this side of the graph, leading to zero lifetime, which is completely unmodulated light. If you have super short lifetimes, such as collagen or urea crystals, you'll have super short lifetimes here. So the length, so these are just some of vectors. If you look at the length of this vector, it's the modulation, and the angle here is the change in phase or change in angle from the reference signal. So what is this phasor? As I mentioned, a phasor is a quantity like a vector. It's just using addition of amplitudes, right, of vectors. And so we have the sine and cosine, and we can do this really quickly using the fast Fourier transform in the time domain. So I just have a really, if you don't want me to explain this, I can just bypass. So let's say that you have a wave here. This is the green wave. And this would be the vector representation of that wave. So the amplitude of the wave is the magnitude or length of the vector. And the phase of the wave is the direction of the vector. So now if we want, we have, let's say, this vector and this wave and this wave. And if we want to add these waves up, what will happen is first you know the vector representation of each individual waves. And notice here the difference between the green and the blue is the amplitude. So the amplitude narrows the vector. And then the difference between this wave and the top wave is there's a phase shift. So then you have this change in direction of the vector. And so you have this angle phi. So if you add vectors, let's say the waves 1 and 2, we will have the addition of those vectors, and R would be the representative wave of adding both vectors 1 and 2 together. And if we add vectors 1 and 3, we will have the R representative of that vector. And then finally, if we add 1, 2, and 3, we would have this representative vector. So that's how the phasors work. So now we take our raw data. This is the intensity at our 16 time windows here. And we can plot the intensity. This would be our decay lifetime, what we get, the raw data that we get from our system. And now we can transform each one of these points into sine and cosine, and then we get our G and S coordinate here for this decay. Okay, so that would be how. So we are adding these waves here, these green and red waves, to get the addition of the final vector, which is our resulting vector here. Okay. And it's our point on our graphical presentation on our plot. So now if we have, let's say, two possible fluorophores, this is where the power of phasors comes in. Because one of the issues is that if you have a pixel that has NADH, but it also has contribution due to some other lifetime, how do you decompose or unmix these possible lifetimes, right? So the power is that, this is a really exaggerated example, but if you have, let's say, fluorophore 1, which is green, and fluorophore 2, which is red, and you want to unmix these, if you actually take your experimental now data and plot that, it would be somewhere in the linear contribution of lifetime 1 and lifetime 2. So we can actually calculate the fractional contribution of those two possible fluorophores.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a mathematically very, well, poorly defined problem to sort of distinguish multiple exponentials.
Yeah.
So it must have the same issue that there are soft modes here, that looking at these two, there must be some ambiguity in what are the two components.
Oh, so the question is, do you have a priori knowledge of what these possible combination of pure components could be?
And to what extent can you'll find a solution, but maybe there are other solutions that are also quite good in parameter space.
Yeah.
I guess that's my question.
Because
it seems like you saw, you know, this. I understand what you're doing, but it is true that, like, for things that I would have expected that you might see, like two exponentials that are added up, that is hard, given noise, to say what are the two decay constants, because there's a whole range of, you know.
Yeah, one thing I didn't explain probably may help. So we have this line here called the universal circle, right?
Yeah.
And that, if any fluorophore lifetime falls on this semicircle, it is a single exponential decay. Right. So that means that the structure of this fluorophore is not undergoing some sort of other transitional states. Mm-hmm. So if the lifetime of the fluorophore is multi-exponential, the lifetime will fall somewhere inside of this circle, because it will be many different states that are given by these linear possible combinations. So you're going to get one point that's somewhere in the center of this fluorophore, and I'm not dissecting those possible contributions of different chromophore states. Does that help?
Yeah, that's
answer?
Helpful.
Yeah.
Excuse me. In principle, each of the chemicals will have their own circle and intensity, right? You must be normalizing it to this circle so that you could do this compositional thing.
I can argue that every single lifetime of any fluorophore will fall in this space.
But don't you need to normalize it because the intensity of different...
The intensity does not have any contribution to fluorescence lifetime. It will not change the fluorescence lifetime of the species unless the molecule is undergoing some sort of transitional state that changes its like some sort of conformation. And that could be due to pH or whatever, but not due to concentration.
Oh, I see. So, but what if you have multiple steps? It's de-excitation.
So like a dipolar realization, which will have multiple steps, you will see a trajectory of these possible steps.
And can you still separate them? Do you separate just the initial and the final, or separate the intermediates?
Yes, so we use fluorophores like Lordan, Actan. These are molecular probes that were synthesized by Gregorio Weber a long time ago. And they're sensitive to their environments. So Lordan will intercalate into the fatty acyl chain of the membrane. And it will actually measure the amount of water that penetrates through the membrane. So you can actually measure lipid organization within the membrane, liquid ordered and disordered.
They all have a unique.
Yes, lifetime. They have a very unique lifetime, but they also have a spectral change, right? So they will emit from green to red light. So, and then you see this kind of trajectory of emissions of different fluorophores. Yeah.
So I forgot, maybe you have mentioned, what is the omega you use to do this analysis? What is the frequency that you use?
So in the data I'm going to show you, the laser frequency is 80 megahertz.
So that's what you use?
Yes.
Does it have, I mean, it doesn't have to be this. This analysis can be done for any omega.
Yeah.
Is there a preferred omega that you use?
Yeah, you have to be fast enough to see the nanosecond decay. So I think 40 megahertz is the minimum.
So you might imagine what you have the data, right? You have the data of I over T, mm-hmm. I versus T.
Yeah.
Right? Then you do the analysis. Analysis is a parameter here, which is omega. Which is the frequency. You basically do whole analysis.
Yes, you do.
And you just plot the real versus the imaginary part.
Yes, yes.
And you pull on this one. Yeah. And, but the frequency, you can do it on different frequencies.
You can use different frequencies.
Do the analysis.
Oh, yeah. So you mean like higher order harmonics? So if
no, but maybe I'm missing something. So if the signal, the I over I, you know, versus T, doesn't have any time scale a priori to it, right? I mean, what you're trying to find out.
Yeah, but we do have a reference signal, which allows us to position all of the phasors to a instrument response time signal.
So omega is the time you put on the pulses?
Yes, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think I'm also confused about that point, because mathematically you can do the, if you get your I of T decay curve, mm-hmm. mathematically you do the Fourier transform, can plug in any omega.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, in
so
fact,
it's
you
not
can.
Part of the measurements.
The raw data is, you have to know the laser frequency to plot what. You know, at these points can actually shift wherever you want depending on omega.
Right.
Right. So, but we know we use 80 megahertz. So we're going to use that signal with our standard that measures the instrument response time so that we know exactly where these points should be according to a standard lifetime. Let's say fluorescein or rhodamine or something. So we know that has rhodamine.
You have a calibration.
You have a calibration, yes.
You want to be there. So.
Yes, yes. And every system should have a calibration. I've been looking at some data I got from some collaborators, and their start time is all over the place. It's not referenced. Like if I put 80 megahertz, is what I thought they used. When I use open all their data, it's like all over the map, and I don't know why that's happening.
But isn't that you just need to Fourier transform your instrument response function with the same omega, and then it will be still consistent?
Yes, exactly. Yes, okay, that's how that's done. Yes.
Omega means. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I know I'm going to a lot of detail about this, and please let me know. I can skip through all this if you don't, when I just go to the metabolism. But I think this is just to show you that this would be the component of pure free NADH. You buy it from Sigma, you dilute it in water, and I will show you some images. You'll image that. The lifetime of pure NADH is 0.4 nanoseconds. The lifetime of pure bound, in this case, bound to LDH, because if NADH binds to another protein, I don't know exactly which ones, like malate, dehydrogenase, it could have different lifetimes. But in this case, it's about 3.4 nanoseconds. Any linear combination would be along this linear trajectory. So with the phasers, you can now get a fingerprint of all possible lifetime components. In this case, this would be the autofluorescence except for GFP in this case. Collagen would be here, it's super short, free NADH, retinoic acid, folic acid, racemal, FAD, arachidonic acid, and coumarin. Well, these two are just to show you if you had a positive, like a non-intrinsic autofluorescence.
So a quick question is for FAD, that's within the circle?
Mm-hmm. FAD, yes. Yes. This is measured.
For that?
This is so it's a multi-exponential, right? That's why it's within the semicircle. Yeah. And you, the maximum absorption of FAD is different than NADH. So it's in NADH, we excite at 740 nanometers. At FAD, you excite at around 800 nanometers. And the emission is different. So it has a different lifetime.
Oh, that's, can I interpret that there's no like free FAD?
There is free FAD. Right. In this case, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Why is it out in the... Yes.
Because I guess these are just like measuring solutions.
These are all in solution, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, sorry, maybe I missed a point. So if you have pure FAD, didn't you say before that it should be on the circle?
If it's a single exponential decay, do you know if it's single exponential?
I don't know. I mean, because I thought like also in cells, I thought like the vast majority of FAD was like covalently attached to protein
as well.
So I'm not sure in this solution.
This measurement came from my student, so I think she may have measured it in the cell. Yeah, but I don't know what the pure FAD component. That's a good point. Yeah.
Another question.
Yeah.
If you have a three-compound complex, where would they lie?
Yes, it's so along, let's say if you have one, two, the third is over here, will be within a triangular, within that.
And can you deconvolve that from the data?
We're looking into that now. Demixing 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay, they all tend to exist as multi.
Yes, yes.
Multi component.
Yeah.
Complexes.
It's not so easy to do.
Yes.
Yeah. we're doing that now. Yeah. Yeah.
If you have a pure chemical that is decaying in a multi-exponential way, what's physically happening?
The structure of this chromophore exists in possible states. Okay. So that's why.
So each state is decaying.
The sum of all of that.
But you have multiple stages meaning the conformational flexibility in the molecule.
Yes. And so if you notice, like really small molecules will have one conformation, so they will most likely be single exponential. The more complex they are, they could exist in multiple states. Okay. So I'm going to explain this metabolic trajectory. And as you all know, we're all here for cellular energetics. And we can actually use this linear combination of free and bound NADH to understand the processes. If cells are altered, are they undergoing more glycolysis or oxidative phosphorylation? And that will fall within this what we call metabolic trajectory. So as I mentioned, those were the images here of pure NADH, pure NADH bound to LDH, so it's uniform. And then these are just macrophages, just to show you an example of cells that are not fluorescently labeled. And then we can actually just take our cursor and highlight all the pixels that contribute to short lifetime or more free NADH lifetimes. And you can see they highlight mostly the nucleus. The yellow pixels have, you know, more free NADH than the purple ones, and that would be in this region of the cell, and then the more bound region, which are more cytoplasmic components. And yes, you can zoom in to see which compartment, let's say which part of the mitochondria or different organelles have different lifetimes. But that was not the purpose of this, just an overview. So NADH, the reason it's fluorescent is due to these two moieties right here, right? So you have the MI group. And when these two structures come together, right, this is the free NADH, it's in a folded state. And because of this, this causes the chromophore not to emit light very well. It's quenched. So this is why the lifetime of free NADH is super short. So lifetime is 0.4 nanoseconds. When it binds to a protein, this chromophore opens up, and now more light is emitted, and the time of arrivals is longer, so 3.4 nanoseconds. And that's why it's very useful. So I guess yesterday, or we had a question of why is NADH fluorescent while NAD plus is not, and it has to do with the low energy form of NAD plus. This is a nicotinamide group here, and you can see it has the plus sign and these bonds here. This is considered to be a low energy state, and now when let's say the NADH, so we go from the oxidized to the reduced form, the change of the form is now an active nicotinamide group in NADH, and it's now high energy state. So because of that, it absorbs light. Both of them can actually absorb light, but NAD plus does not emit light. NADH is the one that emits photons. Okay, so and also in this is really nice because it explains that NAD plus is used for redox reactions, and NADH contributes to the oxidation of cell processes like glycolysis, and that's why, as Dan also mentioned, NADH is a very useful molecule to look at, because we could see whether it's contributing more to the glycolytic pathway or to the oxidative phosphorylation pathway. And that's what this slide is assessing. So what do we know is that in glycolysis, which is happening in the cytoplasm, it's a mostly NADH-producing pathway. So a lot more free NADH is being produced in glycolysis. And NADH is more consumed through this mechanism, the electron transport chain, through the oxidative phosphorylation pathway.
So is your resolution, going back to N0,
Yeah. Can
you do N0 equal 1?
You need enough signal. That's the problem with them.
You can detect single photon.
You can, but you need, so one thing I didn't mention is that when we take an image, every single pixel will have a decay, right? It will say how many photons were emitted at this pixel, this pixel, this pixel, but one frame is not enough statistics to build this histogram. So we actually take like 50 frames and then build our decay within those 50 frames. So it's actually a really slow way to take the data, because now we are talking about seconds, right? To take 50 frames and get enough statistics.
I come from, I know people who do circadian rhythm, so 24 hours is not a problem.
Okay. For me, that's like
even
super
that,
slow.
I mean, it's not technically limiting, right? I mean,
right.
You could do single molecule, you just do many.
Yeah. If you have enough statistics, yeah. You could, theory, yes.
Another question is, so you say you fit it to the decay, right? Mm-hmm. Which is fine. But have you ever, so it all depends on where it's t equals zero. Mm-hmm. So there could be distribution, the one that I talked about the other day, that you actually have a peak, right? Which means that there's a very quiet time, nothing happens.
Yeah.
And then it rises up to it, and then it decays. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, in terms of...
Like there's a refractory type, for example. From t equals zero, the normal distribution, the usual distribution you fit to, in this case, the decay, right?
Yeah.
You're starting with very high, and you say immediately this guy is going to decay. But what about once you excite it, it takes some time for you to reach the stage for it to decay, for it to give out photon.
Yeah.
It's a wait time, finite wait
yes.
time.
Yes, yes.
Is it ever...
Only if it undergoes these other processes, under intersystems
right.
Crossing,
then
it's phosphorescence.
What about, when people look at like photosynthesis, do people do some on that? Do you see that type of thing?
I think it's possible to see that time delay. Yeah, it's very long though, right? Those processes are like in the order of seconds to minutes. I don't know how fast. So you said it takes time for the photons to become emitted. How much time does it
take? Wait time. So suppose if there's just nothing can happen. Once you get excited, like getting two photons, right?
Yeah.
Then you get to the stage you actually start to give out the photon.
Uh-huh.
And so it takes some time to go from here to there.
To there, uh-huh.
And
yeah.
That you should be able to see it. If that's the case, you should be able to see it. But the way you see it is that from t equals zero, when you excite everybody, it takes up nothing, and then boom, something starts to happen, and then it decays.
I guess for most like electronic events, those would be very, very fast.
That's what I'm saying.
Hypothetically, I guess you could have
you
some
could
slow
have
process.
Products.
Yeah, you could. You could.
You could have some intermediate state that takes very long
right.
to go fast.
Right.
Fast.
Yeah.
So for example,
but that's not.
Right. Right. I think people have looked at this with tryptophan. Like, there's some sort of interaction like this. I can get back to you on that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. Okay. So then we see this slide. I'll give credit to the first. I think it was you. I don't remember. Someone showed it. So what we do know about metabolism in tissues is that glucose is broken down to make ATP under oxidative phosphorylation, and that's in the presence of oxygen. We get a lot of ATP, 36 moles per ATP, and in the absence of oxygen, this is anaerobic glycolysis, 2 moles. In this state, we have a low free-to-bound NADH, right? In this process here, which is more the Warburg effect, and that occurs in tumors and proliferative tissue where glucose is being broken down in the presence or absence of oxygen into mostly lactate, it's a high free-to-bound NADH population. So we've done these experiments, and now you could see how this graphical representation is really giving us a window and a way to really look at spatial distribution of lifetimes. So what you're seeing is the cells that are just normal media, and if we take our cursor and we highlight the contribution of lifetimes on this plot, they're mostly plotted over here, more bound NADH. When we add potassium cyanide that inhibits the electron transport chain, the lifetime gets much shorter towards the free NADH here, and you can really see the shift. If you now take cells and induce oxidative stress using hydrogen peroxide, you go from a more free to a more bound state of NADH. So this establishes for us this metabolic trajectory, and you can see it clearly also when you change the media, high glucose, low glucose, you go from a more bound to a more free NADH state. And then if you have tumor cells that are highly glycolytic, you see that they have more free NADH contribution. If we add, let's say, a specific metabolic targeting drug like dichloroacetate, DCA, we shift it to a more bound state. So this is would be exciting for people who are trying to make these molecules to target metabolic pathways.
So question regarding that, like, do you have to do segmentation? Because there are a lot of signals coming from mitochondria. Mitochondria is not doing glycolysis.
Yes, I will get to that. Right now, I'm just showing the overall distribution of free and bound NADH within, let's say, this pseudo-color mapping. So whatever points are here are more pink, whatever points are here are more blue. So it's just a pseudo-coloring of spectra in our image. But you're correct, if you want to get a more quantitative way of looking at lifetimes, you do have to do image segmentation. Yes. So one of the things that we work in our lab in collaboration is on this metabolic trajectory in aging and Alzheimer's disease. So what is the driving biological question for this is that there's a theory that Greg Brewer, who is my next door office neighbor at UCI, he came up with this epigenetic oxidative redox theory, or EORS. And this is a free radical theory of aging that proposes that a sedimentary low energy state with aging triggers an oxidative shift and metabolic dysfunction. So, and further causes metabolic disturbances. So in other words, if we retire and not do anything, we have a sedimentary lifestyle, that's a problem. We're going to actually have a high probability of actually getting more neurotoxicity, oxidative stress, and the potential to accumulate alpha beta peptides in neurons, and that will lead to Alzheimer's disease, right? And if we have a more active lifestyle, the probability of getting Alzheimer's is much lower reduced. And I will show you about this theory. So the hypothesis that we wanted to look at in this contacts of neurons is to look at free NADH in neurons from old mice, because we have mice, and he started a company called BrainBits. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they isolate neurons from brains, and so we're able to culture neurons and have this beautiful like images of these neurons. And we have different types of mice, so old mice and this triple mutant Alzheimer's model mouse neurons. And so the idea was to see if these old mice and these Alzheimer's disease mice neurons had different levels of NADH compared to young age mice. So there are three alternative mechanisms for energy production that maintain NAD plus levels for glycolysis and redox balance. And this is one of the symptoms of, you know, where you have glucose uptake and that leads to glycolysis. If it's glycolytic pathway, you have ATP produced, but then you have this, it breaks down to pyruvate, where we have NAD plus now being oxidative state, oxidating to reduction state, and then we have the mitochondrial electron transport, and it produces NADH, ATP, but also reactive oxygen species. NADH will bind to lactose dehydrogenase, then will lead to lactate, and then of course, if NADH reacts with O2, we have the production also of reactive oxygen species. And so these are the dilemmas in the aging theory. So one of the dilemmas is the paradigm for observation is that oxyradical damage can happens in macromolecules. And this came from a free radical energy conceived by Denham Harmon in the 1950s. And at the time, this opinion was that free radicals were too unstable to exist in these biological systems. And it was then also before anyone invoked free radical as a cause of degenerative diseases. And so two sources impaired Harmon. One was the rate of the living theory, which says that the lifespan of the inverse function of the metabolic rate in turn is proportional to the oxygen consumption. And the second one is Rebecca Gertzman's observations that the hyperbaric oxygen toxicity and radiative toxicity could be explained by the same underlying phenomena as the oxygen free radical. So what we see here is that the impact of the oxidative radical damage is an cumulative cellular damage that leads to organ failure. And the dilemmas is that if you exercise, it does tend to expand life, but it produces a lot of ROS. And this ignores this insulin signaling process. And this genetic reduction of the insulin signaling pathway that was proposed by Carter and other ones, or let's say caloric restriction, in other words, if you go on a calorie-reduced diet, it increases lifespan, and it may decrease metabolism, slower rate of living, but metabolism actually increases. So this is, if you take into account both, they ignore healthy aging, energetics, ROS production, and inflammation. So this is what this whole epigenetic oxidized redox shift is all about. It unifies both this free radical theory and insulin signaling theories. So if we have aging and you have a sedentary lifestyle, you have a redox imbalance and a decrepit mitochondria metabolic shift, and thereby you get epigenetic changes that increases aging. And so it continues and continues on this. So what we know about ROS production is that it could also trigger alpha beta peptide production, increasing your chances of Alzheimer's. Yeah.
Can you go to the flow chart you showed?
Yeah.
No, the next one. You had a.
That one.
Yeah. how do you explain the other mechanism of caloric restriction in this cycle?
Oh, yeah. In this case, the caloric restriction, I guess in this case, the metabolism increases, and that could be good, but it ignores the, I think both of these ignore the production of ROS. And I don't, yeah, you're right, it's not really...
It doesn't quite explain, at least from what I can.
Right. So the insulin signaling is slower rate of, right, in this case, for it's just the problem, right? So you have aging, you have the sedentary lifestyle, and this is just the problem, right? But in this one, I think this just theory is showing that there that all of these, you know, aging itself is causing a chronic inflammation, but normal aging, if you don't have good, let's say, exercise and health, active lifestyle, and if you don't have this balance of food that you consume, it could produce reactive oxygen species. I mean, it has a higher probability of increasing that.
Reduce calories, one could argue the same thing would happen as sedentary lifestyle.
Yeah, it's the same.
Maybe there are some other complex...
We don't know yet the mechanism how caloric restriction
affects
aging. There are many different theories out there, and Dennis is not here today. But if you're interested, you should definitely talk to him next week.
Yeah, I guess the question is...
I mean, this is the first time I'm seeing this epigenetic mechanism on top of the other
theory. I guess the question is, if you have a caloric restrictive diet, it still increases ROS production, although there is a greater lifespan, right?
You mean reactive
oxygen species?
Where is it coming from? If you're the whole point of restricting calories, I thought, was to restrict.
Oh, because it increases the it increases metabolism, so you get more oxphos, and under oxidative phosphorylation, you actually produce a lot of ROS.
Oh,
yeah. So that's the connection.
I think it can be like there's some evidence that ROS can actually feed back on insulin signaling through damaging the proteins in that process. So I mean, I think there is a connection there between ROS and insulin signaling.
And insulin signaling.
I don't know this paradigm though, so I'm not going to try this.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
What about? Is it in the chemistry that the directionality of these elements is included? So why can't we un-age in this time?
Can we un-age? Yeah, that's a good question. This biology is complicated. I don't know if it's just this. Of course, there's telomere length and all this stuff.
So that I get.
Yeah. Can we go backwards?
Rejuvenate.
Rejuvenate. I think, so some people argue that if there's a way, and this is one of the things I'm going to show you, if there's a way to increase the production of free NADH, maybe there is a way to anti-age. All right. Yeah.
Then we could keep us sedentary next time.
And then you can, then you can have a sedentary.
Definitely face cream marketing.
I think there's even a company who sells the NADH as anti-aging pill, which pops up in some.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes.
Lithium or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Point taken.
Yeah. But that's a good that leads to our further our future studies, right? So aging and Alzheimer's share a common characteristic, such as oxidative stress and mitochondrial impairment, bioenergetics. So we've used this triple negative mouse model. I'm just showing you really quickly. With these mouse models, they've showed decreased mitochondrial nuclear density. decreased mitochondrial number with age, and a decline in mobility of mitochondria, which is really important, actually, how mitochondria move in the cells. And that has to do with DRP levels, which is a dynamin-like protein that pinches the mitochondria and undergoes fission. So if those levels go down, then there's a decrease in mobility. So,
are you saying like the? This mouse model like has a defect in DRP.
This mouse model. So all of these mitochondrial structural changes reflect functional deficits of free NADH. And that's the whole point, is a bioenergetic substrate for OxPhos. And this is going back to this vicious cycle involving the redox imbalance. So if we can repopulate our cells with NADH, maybe there's a way to reverse the aging. Right. So we need to do image segmentation, and we can also average phasers. So for example, if we take a cursor and we just isolate specific pixels in our image, and we say, what's the average lifetime of this part of my cursor selection? I'll get 1 point on this plot. What is the average lifetime here? I'll get another point here. And by doing this image segmentation and averaging within those compartments that I selected, now I have an easy way to show the differences between compartments in some way. So that's the idea of the image segmentation here. So this is Alzheimer's genotype, and so this is a lot of data. But basically what you're seeing here is the middle-aged mice compared to the middle-aged triple mutant mice of Alzheimer's. And what you see, this is just showing the vertical line here is the young mice mitochondrial dysfunction for the reference is 0.71. So if we look at just in the mitochondria, you could see that there's definitely a shift more towards the free NADH for the normal middle-aged mice compared there's a more bound state for the triple mutant Alzheimer's model in the mitochondria. Here, there's a little bit of a shift towards more bound in the nuclei, and here is a little bit less. So the highest free NADH is in the mitochondria, then the nuclei, and then the cytoplasm. And the free NADH levels in the triple negative genotype neurons compared to the normal.
So I was a little confused by this yesterday too with the phlegm. You don't actually know in that image where the different compartments are, right? You're almost inferring that from the pattern of the phlegm that you see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then you're...
So, for example, this cursor is in the nucleus.
But do you know that independent of the pattern of NADH?
No, I don't. I'm not looking at this at all. I just take a cursor and I say, oh, what's the average lifetime here? And then a spot shows up there. What's the average lifetime here? And a spot shows up there. But I'm not actually showing, unfortunately, I'm not showing you this plot, which was more informative, right? This one. These individuals.
That one I understand. I think it's more of the, and then you say, well, that's the nucleus, or that's the cytoplasm, or that's the mitochondria.
Yeah.
You don't have any independent information in the imaging that is, in fact, the mitochondria or the nuclei. Is that right?
We have done...
I mean, that's the nucleus for sure.
Yeah.
I thought it yesterday, too.
But it's a similar thing with the mitochondria that, like, so, like, you know, we know from biochemistry that NADH is highly enriched in mitochondria, and then a lot of people, you know, like, have done mitotracker staining and compare that to NADH imaging and say, like, if you look at the bright things in NADH, either the same thing as the bright things in mitotracker. In many, 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 many contexts, they are. I mean,
so you just think it's not necessary anymore to know anything, like you're confident enough in that assignment.
So I have done all of the controls, and the red pixels in the first image are actually labeled mitochondria.
Oh, so you do, then yeah, you do have information.
And those are TMRE labeled, so the ones that are, they have high membrane potential.
This is what I was, it's actually not a critique, it's like, It seems yeah. like you could at the same time label so it. You, stuff
yeah.
and
then
so yeah.
You yes, we did that. Yeah, so yeah. that would be the label mitochondria, and then this is the autofluorescent signal. So if okay. you have one that's spectral.
So in the same, because I'm not really a microscopy person, but
yeah,
in
the same,
like
the same image.
You're just collecting different fluorescent information,
exactly.
some of which is phlegm.
Yeah.
But the others could be like, for example, if I had a fly
yeah.
and it had a GFP labeled protein, and yeah. I wanted to ask, does my NADH bound correlate with that?
Right.
You could get that signal from the GFP, and
yeah.
as long as that didn't interfere with your phlegm signal, you could have the two and overlay them.
So back to the question of decomposing. You know, you have a dot, you have a cloud in the middle, and you say it's a linear combination between the bound and unbound.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not doesn't have to be. I mean, that's okay. That's a hypothesis. There could be a third. Doubly bound or half bound, I don't know, that actually pulled this point away from, we do see some deviation from the.
Yes, that's correct. I'm going to show you, yes, I have some time, the embryos, and I will show you a completely different trajectory.
Okay.
That's nowhere along this linear bound of free NADH.
Michelle, could you repeat, what did you say was the typical exposure time for this kind of
emission? For one frame, or for accumulation of frames, or per pixel.
So if you wanted to go back and forth between the two of
them. Oh, okay. So how we do that is we first just image mitochondria with one photon. We switch over to two photon. We get the phlegm. Yeah.
Michelle, is this level related to the expression level of the NADH or NAD plus binding proteins?
NADH. Oh, what are the proteins bound? What proteins are binding to?
The expression level. Then you continue this. Level, right?
Ah, yes. So expression level of enzymes, you mean.
Right.
Could it? Yes. In fact, that's why it would move along this trajectory. So you have less bound, it would be more free. Yes. So
it'll check the protein level at the same time?
I don't know. Could we infer protein levels from this? That's a good question. I have not done that. Yeah.
It's not necessarily that this change is due to protein level change, right? It could be because of the kinetics.
Right.
Not necessarily.
Right. NADH can be consumed.
It could be.
Yeah, there are multiple things that happen. NADH is also consumed during high stress through the first responders of DNA damage. So that also is another issue. So in this case. So here we have now the young, middle, and old age mice comparing. So young would be 3 to 4 months old, middle age 9 to 10 months old, and old age between 18 and 23 months old. And you could see that compared to the triple mutant mice, what we see basically is that you have the genotype here is the normal and the mutant. The free NADH levels go down a little bit on the triple mutant one. And then there's a significant change here with the old and triple negative. So the older the mice are, so the younger they are, they're closer to each other in terms of free NADH. The older they are, there's a more significant difference in reducing free NADH levels.
So it's like curious, I mean, like with either comparing the wild type to the mutant or with the different ages, to what extent are there changes in neuronal morphology or electrophysiology, like those type of things?
That has been done already, but I don't know the data for that. Yeah, that's a good question, though.
So, also, like, okay, so again, it's probably the second patient thing again. You have done that, it was great. Like, is this analysis, like, done on the different part of the segmented part, or is actually the average of the whole cell, the bar plots that you showed?
Oh, in this case, the ones before were segmented in mitochondria, nucleus, cytoplasm. In this case, I think we're averaging all of it. In this case, just mitochondria.
Okay, so levels. Because I think it's kind of almost mysterious why all the different compartments, the trend of the change are the same. Because
yeah.
Right, like if you explain that with oxpos and glycolysis, what happens in the nucleus? Right?
Yeah, that's true. But there's not too much of a thing. So there's most of the changes in the mitochondria, then a little bit less in the nucleus and much least in the cytoplasm in terms of comparison.
So like nucleus is changing nucleus greater than that of cytoplasm.
Yeah,
For example, it's a mystery to me.
That is a mystery, yeah. But NADH is used in the nucleus, right, by other processes.
Oh, for example?
It plays a role in transcription. It's used as a substrate for unwinding the DNA. So, and then I don't remember all the other processes, but it was surprised by that actually, that's used in the nucleus.
Sure.
Any other questions? Yeah.
So, can you go back to the bar graph?
This one?
Okay, so that's the free NADH. So that shift could be due to so many things like change in the rate of production, change in the rate of consumption, change in the rate of proteins that bind one or the other.
It could be a different protein that's bound, yeah.
Yeah, so can you deconvolute all of those things? Because I'm not sure, so what interpretation can you really make about what's happening in the physiology from these data?
Yes. I guess I should rephrase this as concentration of free NADH in micromolar. How this was calculated, I'm going to talk about it in the next segment.
That's going to be a function of how fast it's made.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's true. So the question is, now we're no longer looking at lifetimes, but the question is it due to some other process, right? Which processes it's undergoing. Yeah, I think you would have to use some sort of inhibitors or something to isolate or knock down of some sort of proteins in those pathways or something to see if that's changing. But that's a very good question. It could be a possibility that it could be bound to a different protein, but because it falls within this linear so another thing that's really interesting is this species right here. This here is the signature of reactive oxygen species, which I'm going to talk about in the next couple of slides. But I don't know. I guess we shouldn't rule all those other processes out. And how to dissect those, I think it would require specific inhibitors or something to knock down pathways or maybe see if there's a production of a metabolic enzyme that's being produced within those triple mutant Alzheimer models. That's a good point.
Just proteomics to see.
Yeah, proteomics. Yeah. That would be probably a good step for that. Okay. This is just the comparison of male versus female mice in the mitochondria. And the highest free NADH fraction in the mitochondria for the females suggests that mitochondria have highest capacity for free NADH compared to nuclei and cytoplasm. For all of them. See, mitochondria for all of them is pretty high, the fraction of free of NADH fraction. And then by gender, in terms of normal versus triple mutant, the male neurons were more lower in fraction NADH than neurons in the young. So this is, let's say, the old mice here, middle and young, and this is the male percent of female free NADH. So comparing the male versus female in the normal. So there is changes, there's differences between male and female mice in terms of mitochondrial free NADH production. And it's mostly in the young and middle that vary, but when they get old, they're similar. And then there's a gender difference in the middle young of all compartments, but no significant gender differences at old age. This is...
I'm a little confused about the y-axis. What's the percentage?
So this is 100% would mean equal male to female, right? So in the mito, they're the same for old. They're the same for, nuclear and there's a lot of variable here, but more or less they're the same. Male and females look the same for mitochondria, but they don't look the same in young and middle. They're a little bit different, and that may explain, that could be explained due to their metabolic differences for, development and different processes that male versus female undergo for reproduction and things like that. Okay, so I'm not going to summarize all this, but we published this in Geroscience just this year, and it's age and Alzheimer's related redox states. So in future directions, how could age-related deficits in intracellular NADH be assessed, and how can we control this? How can we reverse this process? And we're thinking about adding probably NADH or precursors of NAD to increase the levels of NADH to see what's happening within the cell. And
is that distinguished? I don't even know this. Distinguished kind of people do, like, is that known that works, let's phrase it that way, that if you add a precursor that the cell will get more NAD,
Production of NADH, of NADH goes up. We've used this for DNA damage and repair, and we've seen the levels of free NADH increase.
And like how much can you change?
I don't know in terms of molarity, how much.
Like rough, I mean, is it like a...
Is it significant?
Like a 1% change, or is it like a factor of like 10 or...
I would say more than 10%. But maybe not as much as what you would want it to be. Yeah.
Maybe you said this, but from individual to individual, the same age group, what is the variability?
Individual to individual within the same age?
Yeah.
Ooh, we averaged all those ages, so I don't know. I guess if you go
if you add, okay. So you already see age difference, right?
Yeah.
But if you say middle age, man, what is the variation?
The variation is that...
What's the sample size?
Oh, how many mice were done?
Yeah.
Ooh, probably, I don't know, like 20 mice per sample.
You
have a lot of cells from those 20 mice.
So you can get a variation from mice to mice variation.
Yeah. I mean, we have the data, so we can look across each mice to see if there's a variability within the same age population. That would be a good point. Yeah.
So what about mice that are calorically restricted intermittent fasting is actually the new rage in this field. Right? You can still eat as much, you just can only eat it during
That's a great question. I would love to look at the metabolism of those keto diet mice. but I don't know. We have not done those studies. Okay.
I'm still fussing about how fast things are formed and how fast they're used. So suggests that higher reductive capacity in females, but then how do you know that it's not actually that females have a lower ability to use NADH?
Yeah.
So maybe the females are less effective at oxidizing NADH, which then I wouldn't call a higher reductive capacity.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Just say that.
Yeah, so the reason they have more NADH is because it builds up because they're not as effective at using it.
Yeah. That could be another explanation, honestly. Yeah. Yeah, that could be another explanation. I don't know. That's a good point. I have to think about that one.
One other question on this slide. Do male and female mice have significantly different lifespans?
Not a mouse expert. So in the lab, I think like a year old mice is pretty old, or 2 years is even older, like really old. But I don't think people really use mice that are, these are ancient mice. Like no researcher would use these mice. But I don't know how long they live. Okay, so The last topic I'm going to discuss is metabolism during mouse embryo development. And I think some of you asked, you know, how do you know this linear trajectory is the metabolic trajectory? And all of the cells that we've ever looked at, kidney, liver, brain cells, all differentiated tissue, and including iPS cells, and including stem cells, have this, they're really smack in the center of our polar coordinate system, except for these. And I will show you the mouse development. So very nice, Dan showed us some beautiful images of the oocyte, as well as the 2 to 8 to marula cells that are embryos that we're dividing. And this is just a really brief overview of a lot of work that's gone into looking at energy metabolism of the development of mice. And they just really broadly categorize this is oxidative phosphorylation, and then once the embryo goes to blastocyst, this is glycolysis. But actually, there's a lot of steps in here that switch the metabolism of these developing mice. So I would say this is pretty much a not very accurate look at energy metabolism, because we know that in the first stages of embryo development, hexokinase is inhibited, and then it converts, as it increases in changing now the metabolism, it uses more glucose. So there's definitely switches here. And if we look at the activity of the metabolic cofactor of NADH during the pre-implantation embryo, from the fertilized oocyte to this 2-cell embryo, there's a pyruvate, which is the key energy uptake and increases cleavage. And then from the actually day 3, from the 8-cell embryo to the marula, there's a switch in metabolism here. So oxygen consumption increases in the marula to blastocyst stage. So in these processes, we could say, infer, that NADH goes to NAD+, and that leads to an increase of free NADH from the early stages of embryo development. And then in the later stages, because you have now oxidative phosphorylation, you have a more bound NADH happening here. So we thought this would be simple to look at the signatures of the developing embryo in our phaser coordinate system. And as Dan mentioned, the reason for this is because studies have shown that metabolism is actually associated with embryo viability, and that would be important for IVF and all these other places that use IVF. And you could see that this is just from Gardner et al. And all these people that have shown that glucose uptake can be a measure of good embryo health. And so what we wanted to develop is an imaging strategy, non-invasively image these embryos, and we can image them overnight as a function of development. And this is the thing that really, like, we weren't sure what was going on in very initial stages. So the 2-cell embryo signature is here. And then when the cell goes to 8-cell stage, it slightly shifts a little bit more towards the shorter lifetime. And then it switches again in the marula to a longer lifetime until it gets to the early blastocyst stage. You see the lifetimes getting closer to the middle of this plot where we see all of our cells here. So we know that at 2-cell stage, these are totipotent stem cells. We have very different epigenetic things, controls that are happening. And especially when they get to blastocyst, we're now starting to see signatures that look like what we've seen in every other cell type. So what we are wondering...
I'm curious because I like that title, or I'm interested in that title. What's the lipid lifetime?
Okay, right. This took a long time to figure out. Why is this lifetime going like this, right? Closer and closer to the middle, and why is it being pulled like this? That has to do with reactive oxygen species production due to the change in oxidative phosphorylation. And I will explain in the next couple of slides this. But first, if we highlight now the spatial, let's say, all the pixels painted now with 2-cell, 8-cell, marula, early blastocyst, and late blastocyst, you could see that the blue pixels highlight the 2-cell embryo. Now it goes from long to short, and then to much longer in this direction. And each one of these has a unique signature, which is really nice. It told us that the signature for that cell embryo is here in that polar coordinate plot. And so.
It's the same embryo. Mm-hmm. It's the same embryo over time.
Yes, the same embryo over time. And so we now, if you look at 1950s data and go back to what people have done in terms of biochemistry, most people don't even look at 1960s papers, but we had to really understand what was happening. We know that pyruvate uptake is happening at the two-cell embryo. Free NADH goes down. So at the two-cell to four-cell stage, we have shift or shorter lifetime. And now I can't say this is really NADH. This is a very unique signature. It is in my emission spectra. It is showing that it could be NADH. It might be bound to another enzyme, hence a different signature here as opposed to the center. But what I do know is that it goes to the shorter lifetime here. And then 4 to 8, free NADH should increase. This is why we get this shift here. And then it switches again to this bound NADH state. And then it's going towards this part of the curve. And that's the question, is why is it going there? But it does match the literature. So
when you the development, number of cells keeps growing, right?
Yeah.
And the dot you're showing there, or the cloud you're showing there, is over all the cells.
Over all the cells.
Are there any difference between the earlier cell and the later cell, or?
You mean like,
oh, they're all synchronous.
Between these two cells, or they look different?
I'm just saying, yeah, right. It's the motion, I mean, somehow signify the actual overall trend of development?
Yeah, this is what we call the developmental trajectory, no longer called the metabolic trajectory.
They do that together.
They do that.
The new guys go in there, and the old guys still stay in the same place.
Right.
Everybody goes there.
Yes. We've imaged many, many, many embryos, and they all have this developmental trajectory in all different stages.
But all the cells within the embryo at that stage look similar. It's not like there's a...
Yeah. It's not the new ones going there and old ones still stay in the old place. Because you do see larger gap.
On the average?
Everyone's the same age.
That's what I'm saying. That's all synchronized dividing.
Yes.
But you do see the cloud become bigger.
Yeah.
The scatters become much bigger.
Yeah. And if you talk to developmental biologists that have really a lot of knowledge about this embryo process, developmental process, they'll tell you that one of these cells is different. They're like the leader of the pack, and they have a unique metabolism. I'm averaging everything here, so you don't see that. So the dominant species is everything.
But you could do that, right? Your resolution is good enough to do this.
Yeah. And I have, and I've seen that there's one cell that looks different. Yeah.
Wow. Which one is that?
I don't know. I can't. By eye, they all look the same.
When you first see the leader of the pack show up, is it at the morning?
In the marula, yeah. You see in the marula. I don't know if it's the one that starts to distinguish between these compartments in the blastocysts, because there are like cells that will outline the ectoderm, and they will form like different parts of the layers of the embryo. So yeah, that's, we do see that. I'm averaging everything. So the dominant species is that one here. Mm-hmm.
But you're able to follow a single cell from the beginning to the end.
Yes, if you have enough signal, but it gets tricky, as Dan mentioned, because you have to identify which is a single cell in this mess. And it becomes a little bit tricky because, you start to get more dense stuff here. So you really have to, so the way that we did this, we took Z-stacks, we averaged the entire thing. We didn't want to expose the embryo too much to light. So I'm averaging everything. But in theory, yeah, you could do that.
It's probably a late stage to ask this question, but what embryo is this?
Mouse. Yeah. Okay, so what the heck is the signal that's going to a long lifetime species? Enrico and his students published this work, which was really nice because it gave us finally an explanation of what was happening. If you look at the lifetime signature, it's about 7.8 nanoseconds, really long. And in this case, the cells were fed oleic acid, and you can see the oxidative stress signal here. A lot of lipid oxidation is what's happening. When you express, if you have too much ROS, you have high lipid oxidation. And that signature shows up in our lifetime data. It's this pull here towards the long life type species. So finally, we were able to know that ROS production is actually really important in embryo development. It's needed. And there's like a balance of how much ROS production there is before the cell, the embryo just dies. And it increases really highly when it's at the 8-cell stage and it's starting to undergo oxphos.
So can you like grow the guys in like with a lot of antioxidants and then
does that
signal go away?
I have not done that. But in order for us to verify this, we looked at the ROS, the reactive oxygen species dye, DCFDA. This is a terrible dye because it doesn't tell you anything about, the intensities don't tell you how much ROS is there. It just tells you that it is there. So all this green signal at the bottom just says that there's ROS in every single stage, but the intensities don't say how much ROS there is. It's just yes or no. So what we use is a correlative analysis using third harmonic generation to look at lipid. And so what we're now looking at the data together, the lifetime data and the third harmonic data, and what you see is that as a function of development, the third harmonic generation correlates very strongly with the long lifetime species that's coming up. So we highlighted just the long lifetime species part of the lifetime data, and we said what pixels correlate with those third harmonic lipids, and there's an increase in total lipid and ROS, so we think that this is due to lipid oxidation. And you could see that it actually starts within these compaction early blastocyst and late blastocyst stage, and that's the pull of the lifetimes towards the long lifetime species.
You said the thermal signal is lipid droplets, so is that just...
So third harmonic generation gives you it's any change of water interface with membranes, so wherever there's a change in refractive index, you're going to get a signal. And that's a high signal for any lipids.
So which one is the third harmonic channel in the false colors?
E?
The top?
This one.
So it looks like that there are some droplets.
Yeah, that's true. There are lipid droplets in there.
I mean, is the third harmonic, have you thought about using cars or something like that? Or like one of those type of things to look at it?
Yeah, we didn't. We used CARS for the long lifetime species, yes, to identify the oxidation of the lipids. So that's how we know it was oxidation of lipids. But I didn't use CARS for this. I just used the third harmonic. Yeah.
So is the third row colocalization?
Yes, colocalization.
So green is?
Third harmonic, just lipids. There's lipids everywhere, right?
The green is lipids, and red is?
The long lifetime species signature colocalized with the third harmonic. Yeah. Okay, so we can shift the metabolism of these embryos. If we use rotenone antimyosin A to inhibit oxphos, we see that these signatures go from oxphos to more glycolytic state. So there is a shift, and each one of these is an embryo, an average phasor for an embryo. And that's what the image looks like. And if we now inhibit glycolysis using 2-DEG or 2-deoxyglucose, we can shift the metabolism from a glycolytic state to a more oxphos state. So these are done for that stage embryos. And so now if we culture embryos in different media, so here are normal caseal media. This is just after 3 hours. So by eye, you can't tell the difference whether these embryos look good or not. They look pretty good in all 3 hours. This is flush holding media, nutrient deficient media. This is just PBS. And then the lifetime signatures look very different. So you could see that the signature of the caseal media, normal media, is here. This is the nutrient deficient media, and this is the PBS media. So each one of these lifetimes is in a unique part of our polar coordinate system. And then, of course, after 24 hours, you could see death and all the terrible stuff that happens to the embryo. So now we have a pipeline that we could now use to predict embryo viability using this phasor polar coordinate system. And you can image these embryos over time, and you now have a way to look at healthy embryos that went to blastocyst stage, unhealthy embryos that arrested at Marula. They did not go on to divide. And if you take FLIM for all these steps, you have a signature for each one of these. But you can develop a computer algorithm, machine learning tool, to be able to take this data, the distribution of the polar coordinates of the ones that survived, the ones that did not survive, and see what is the distance between these polar coordinates. It's the degree of separation of healthy and unhealthy embryos to derive a predictive map of whether embryos are going to divide or, let's say, go on to the next stage. So we've done this. This is called the distance analysis. And for the sake of time, I don't have to go in. I can't go into all the details about this. So I'm happy to talk to anyone about this. But now you put in, you use a test set. We know these survived, these did not. This is our test set. And we put in our unknowns. And then now use this viability index to distinguish healthy and unhealthy embryos. And then FLIM does not cause DNA damage, so we did a lot of tests to look at how much laser power will induce the damage. And of course, at 10 milliwatts, we do see a decline in the development of the blastocyst. 2-cell to 4-cell stage embryos were used, and you could see these didn't develop very well. 2-cell to 4-cell are very finicky. They don't like to be imaged, but 8-cell marula to blastocyst stage are more robust. And then, so the optimal power is 3.5 milliwatts. This is what we are using in our FLIM analysis. And of course, 10 milliwatts, just too much power. They start to die. So another thing that we could do in this case is calculate the absolute concentration of NADH. If we use an external light or a non-modulated signal, we have actually three polar coordinates. This could be a simulated unmodulated signal or external light. So what will happen is because the quantum yield, the free NADH, is really low, what happens is that we can reposition now the free NADH according to the same amount of unmodulated light used, so the quantum yield doesn't perturb our total concentration values. Because, as I mentioned, FLIM is an independent from concentration, but we can, but because the quantum yields of NADH and free and bound are different, we need to be able to correct for that difference in quantum yield. And by using this unmodulated light, we correct this on our polar coordinate system. This is the correction factor, which is the amount of modulation of the signal of the unmodulated light, the intensity of the unmodulated light, and the intensity of the fluorescence of the specimen. And so, using this correction now, if we have a control where we know this is our absolute concentration of a control, let's say 100 micromolar, we can now correct and move these phasors to the correct position. And by doing this, let me show you in the next step here. So this would be our raw data. And the correction now using the external light will be now along this axis, which now corrects for the amount of the quantum yield of the free NADH. And what you could see here is that these pixels have more, let's say, the concentration of the absolute concentration of NADH. So that would be here. This would be, the green pixels will be 29 micromolar. The red pixels are 89 micromolar. And the pixels here will be 12 micromolar. So we're able to actually calculate the absolute concentration of NADH within cellular compartments and get a map of concentration of NADH. And so in NADH and in normal cells and cancer cells, they're in the range of 90 to about 168 micromolar NADH. So we've done...
What are these two blobs? What are these two red regions? I'm sorry, I don't.
Oh, what compartments are these?
Yeah.
It looks like mitochondria to me, but it can go back. So here's the intensity image. You could see the very bright regions are mitochondria. So they have the highest amount of
They are all clustered?
No, they're not. They're just saying that this is 89 micromolar NADH in these regions. And this is where mitochondria is, the highest concentration of NADH here. These are less concentrated NADH, about 29 micromolar. Yeah. And then we've done this for embryos. This is the absolute concentration of NADH. At the 2-cell stage, we have about 60 micromolar. At the 8-cell stage, 80 micromolar. Blastocyst actually goes down to about 20 micromolar NADH. And if you look at papers, and this is a 1984 paper of the time of nutrient uptake, picomole per embryo, you'll see that the 2 and the 8 to 16 stage embryo have a nutrient uptake that's pretty low, and then at the marula stage, it's still low, but at the blastocyst stage, now you see a high amount of, so the difference here is glucose uptake and pyruvate uptake. So it kind of correlates with the absolute concentration. And this is preliminary data for us. So we're trying to understand this decrease in total concentration of NADH at the blastocyst stage, which seems to match the nutrient uptake of the glucose at the blastocyst stage. So, and so here's the absolute concentration in different media. In the casome normal media, 100 to 150 micromolar. This is at the 2-cell stage. And if you change the media, nutrient-lacking media, the total, any absolute concentration goes down. And again, this is preliminary data, so I need a lot more statistics for this. Okay, so finally, this paper was published this year if you want more information. But as you could see, the polar coordinate phasor analysis was really important for us to determine a developmental trajectory of the metabolic processes of the developing embryo. It gave us information about what else could be happening in the embryo, such as reactive oxygen species production and these very long lifetime species production. And it is more quantitative, but that's why I'm here, to work with more people who can model this or can calculate maybe some of these metabolic processes. And we have the data, we have the calculation, the actual parameters of some of the parameters you would need for modeling, so that would be great to collaborate. Or if anyone wants to come to our P41 center, we're happy to host you. We don't charge for any of our facilities, as long as you can find a place to live and eat. You're welcome to come, and we have 17 different systems, and all of our systems have a FLIM system, because we are able to program our own FLIM card. So. And yeah, I don't think I have time for this. I was going to talk a little bit about the collagen and the substrate influence of metabolism, but I think you look tired. I'll just end there. Okay. So I'd just like to acknowledge my group. I had 5 PhD students and they all graduated, but the work that did, the person who did all the work on embryos was Dr. Ning Ma. She's now at Stanford doing a postdoc. These are my new students over there. My collaborators, the Alzheimer's and aging mouse, Greg Brewer and Yue Dong, his student who graduated as well, and Ken Cho, he's a developmental biologist, and Soledad, who was the key person in his group, and 2 students. That helped with the embryo analysis and all the funding sources. So thank you so much for your attention.